Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Save big money at Menards. Keep your lawn looking its best with Menards' premium four-part fertilizer program. Each step is tailor-made for the health of your lawn. Get started this spring with a bag of crabgrass preventer with lawn food. Apply just once early in the spring to feed your lawn for over 2 months. Pick it up in our garden center today and check out Menards.com for more hot deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi, everybody. I'm Joanna, and this is Hyphenated, the podcast about living in the hyphen. Today, I have a very special guest. I gave him the honor of joining this podcast. He's a longtime fan of the podcast and of me, actually, since the day I was born. It's crazy. So my dad, Ricardo Hausmann, is a very well-known economist. In fact, a lot of people tend to be shocked when they find out that Ricardo Hausmann has a daughter that does what she does. So I'm super excited to have my dad joining me on this podcast. We're actually, this is the first time we record Hyphenated outdoors, because my dad said, it's a beautiful day. We should record the podcast outdoors. I didn't want to, but here we are.
So if you hear some birds singing, and now you know why.
Yeah. Exactly. They're our chorus. They're supporting us. They're telling us we're doing a good job. Bobby, you've been listening to Hyphenated since it came out.
Since it came out.
You listen to every week.
Every week, religiously.
But it's funny because you listen to mostly, like, ever since I have consciousness, you devour complicated books and, like, lessons on tape and, I don't know, metaphysical explanations of whatever by a dude called Dr. Greenberg. Like, you're always constantly feeding your brain with really high-level intellectual content. I'm shocked you listen to Hyphenated. Is it just because you miss me, or?
Well, I mean, I do miss you. I mean, I live in Boston and in the Berkshires. You live in New York. I don't see enough of you, so I definitely miss you. But I think this is a pretty intellectual thing. You're constantly thinking deeply about, you know, what makes Latin American societies different, in what dimensions do they differ, and how human experiences are different in about a birthday party or about you know, growing up as a girl or as whatever it is, you find interesting insights into the nature of the societies you have grown up in. And I find that fascinating.
Well, that's very similar to what you do, except you do it more with numbers, right? So ever since I was very young, I knew that your class at Harvard was called Why Are Some Countries Poor, Volatile, and?
Unequal.
And that's it. There's no rich country.
Actually, why are so many countries poor, volatile, and unequal?
Oh, wow. It's an uplifting title. So I am going to be honest with you. I tend to not have a lot of patience when you sort of have tried to teach me about economic theory and about why so many countries are poor, volatile, and unequal. But, you know, now I'm 33. So I'm an adult, officially, sort of. Not really. Kind of. I'm trying. Yesterday I got in trouble because I showed my nephews Scream 5 and no one slept and everyone's mad at me in the house except for my dad. So I don't know how adult I am, but I am someone that really likes to analyze human existence, culture, and I think that's what economics sort of is, except it's why do the it might have quant in it, but ultimately it's about humans and the resources they have around them.
Right. So, you know, some people have math phobia, but really...
Like, I have math phobia. You tried to teach me math, and it's the only time you yelled at me when I was little is when I didn't understand how to do integers. Anyway, continue.
So math is what the people who are not extremely smart use, to keep track of what they're saying. So, you know, if you're extremely smart, you can follow your own logic. If it gets too complicated, it's better to write it down as equations and let the algebra do the work that your thinking would have done otherwise. So actually, it is something that makes thinking easier, not harder.
I mean, that's for you, because you're a math genius. You know, I barely scrape by in algebra. But
imagine me as a grade schooler. Okay, imagine me, which you can, because you always tell me you miss me as a grade schooler. Imagine I'm a grade schooler.
I want you to walk me through basically a semester of your class in 30 minutes, but also I have the brain of a not as smart person.
Okay, so I would say the following, you know, the difference between rich countries and poor countries is that rich countries know how to do more stuff. And so in some sense, the most important thing there is in life is knowing how to do stuff.
This is what your students at Harvard pay so much money for?
Imagine.
I'm kidding.
When people ask me, how come you have a daughter who's a comedian and so on? And I say, what do you think I am? I entertain people. I'm in the entertainment business. They pay me a lot of money to entertain them. Right? I do like a mini series, which is called The Course. It has like 24 episodes, right? And you want people to be entertained so that they remember, and you want to use metaphors and jokes and stuff. So I don't know that our two fields are that distant from each other.
That's true. High five.
High five.
Okay, back to the lesson plan. So let's concentrate on Latin America, because you love Latin America. I love Latin America. We're from Latin America. A lot of our audio, how do we say? It's not televidentes.
podescuchas.
And nuestro podescuchas are also very interested in Latin America. So why don't we take Latin America sort of like a case study, all right? So which country in Latin America would you say, hey, you know what you're doing? You're doing good. High five.
Well, you know, unfortunately, we don't have sort of like great examples of superb success in Latin America. I would say that, you know, countries like Costa Rica, Uruguay, maybe Chile have been doing relatively better than others. But I am, you know, as a Latin American, I look at other parts of the world and ask, why can't we replicate that? Why can't we do that? And so I've been struggling to ask myself, you know, what could be sort of like the secret sauce? And in the end, I think that there is no secret sauce. And that's why these things cannot be solved overnight, and it takes time. The fundamental issue is know-how, is to know how to do things. Because, you know, in the end, you know, we are here in the countryside. This is a beautiful thing. You have a beautiful meadow, etc. But you don't want a beautiful meadow. You want an omelet with toast and coffee and milk. How do you go from a beautiful meadow to an omelet? Well, you know, somebody needs to know how to grow chicks and chickens and eggs and cows and milk and cheese. And all of these things are transformations of the world that are purposefully done by humans so that, you know, you can have an omelet.
You know, I love that you use the example of omelet, because that's the only thing you've ever cooked me.
Well, it's the only thing I know how to cook.
We have that in common as well. So tell me a country that has a great amount of know-how and knows how to appropriately use that know-how to, I don't know, I guess export, import. I know those two words.
Okay, so, you know, it's amazing if you look at countries, say, like Austria. It's a country of, I don't know, some 10 million people. And they do everything you could imagine. They know how to do everything. They do machines, they do pharmaceuticals, they do whatever. They do all the complicated things to do. I use a simple metaphor. You see, the difference between countries that know how to do a lot of things and countries that know how to do few things is not because the countries that know how to do a lot of things are full of geniuses.
Right.
So it's not something that happens at the level of the individual.
Right.
It is something that happens at the level of the society. Because, you know, to tell you the truth, the number of books written every year keeps on growing exponentially. Mm-hmm. The number of books ever written grows even faster, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have all the books of the past plus what it grows every year. Our capacity to read those books is not growing. I mean, Oscar Wilde, would probably have read more books than I could ever.
Probably.
But I don't believe I have so much more books to read, right? Yeah. So, because there's so much more stuff out there. So it's impossible for people to know everything. So the way knowledge grows is not by putting all the knowledge on every head, but by putting different bits of knowledge in different heads. So as a consequence, you know, your dentist tends not to be your lawyer.
You know, it depends. You don't know Dr. Shlomo. You know, I'm kidding. Of course. Right. And it's, you go to different people for, and you know what I've noticed? Remember when I had that really horrible bike accident?
Mm-hmm.
Where I shattered my elbow in 60 places, and we were in the middle of Cape Cod, and we were in this hospital that I guess was kind of in a more rural part, and there were no specialized doctors. And then we flew into Boston, sort of almost like an emergency, and we went to a doctor that specialized only in elbows. He did not operate anything other than elbows. But, you know, in other places, you would have a general orthopedic surgeon do that surgery. But since we were in Boston and there was so much know-how, I guess, and so many people, that this doctor could specialize and only look at elbows. So, I mean, he probably had some of the most famous tennis players come and hang with him, you know?
Absolutely. So that is, you've captured something very, very important. See, the difference between a poor country and a rich country is a little bit like the difference between their medical facility up there in Cape Cod near Provincetown, where you were first treated, and, you know, the major city hospital, say MGH. In the major city hospital, doctors have specialized.
Yeah.
So some do only elbows, and others do only hand, and others do only knees, etc. Okay? But the hospital as a whole has diversified. So the hospital can do many, many things,
yeah.
Not because its doctors can individually do many, many things,
mm-hmm.
but because you put different bits of know-how in different heads.
And then put it all in the same place. So that hospital is like Austria.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Exactly.
Look at that. Look at that. This type of math I can do. Austria equals hospital.
Exactly.
There it is. It just, if you take the numbers away, I can do the math. Okay, so give me another example of a country that has the high-quality hospital-like attributes of know-how. And maybe give me an example of a country who maybe has all this know-how, but maybe doesn't have the hospital, doesn't have the system to put all these people in the same place. Or, you know, or maybe those people, that those elbow doctors go to another hospital, go to another country.
So, attracting talent has always been a source of acceleration because, you know, Malcolm Gladwell says it takes 10,000 hours to become really good at something.
Yeah, that's why I'm so great at complaining. I'm doing all my dad jokes.
So 10,000 hours is, at 40 hours a week, is 5 years. And we don't have chunks of 5 years to spare,
right,
in a lifetime. So we tend to become good at few things. But we need, our prosperity depends on everybody else knowing about different things. I don't know how to make antibiotics. I don't know how to make shoes. I don't know how to make cars. I don't know how to make gasoline. I don't know how to make entertainment. I don't know how to make many things that I consume.
I think you're very entertaining.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable, but the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on Auto Trader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.
So how does this know-how get into those brains? Well, it takes a long time, as Malcolm Gladwell says. It takes 10,000 hours. But assuming the 10,000 hours, these 5 years it takes to become good at something, say, how long does it take to move a brain?
I mean, it depends on if you're flying Delta, you know, you could be 20 minutes late.
if it's Delta, it must take forever. So the fusion of know-how has always had a lot to do with the movement of people. And that's one thing that tends to accelerate the process of growth. It's that if you don't know how to do something, you just bring somebody who does. Because typically, you don't know how to do the things you don't do, and you cannot start doing the things that you don't do, because to start doing those things, you have to know how to do them, but you don't know how to do the things
in
you
order,
don't do.
You get caught in a loop. If there's not one person that knows how to do something, then you're never going to learn how to do it.
So, yeah, you know, you won't find watchmakers in places that don't make watches. But then how do you become a watchmaker in a place that doesn't make watches? But you need watchmakers to make watches. So how do you get the process going? So human mobility has always been a very important source of technology diffusion. And there's a lot of obstacles that people put to the movement of humans. You know, typically at a border, there's a policeman, he asks for a visa, a permit, a passport, etc. And if you want to get a job, you need to, you know, you have some requirements. For example, to be a university professor at a public university in Panama, you have to be a citizen of Panama.
That's so dumb.
Yeah. And there are like 29 professions that are reserved only for citizens of Panama.
So wait, what you're saying is countries that open themselves up to talent from anywhere and that facilitate the movement of know-how into their country, immigration, those tend to be successful because they're bringing those brains into the hospital. They're bringing those elbow doctors in.
Absolutely. And let me give you an extreme example.
I love extreme examples. Bring it on.
Okay. So everybody, you know, they say that Silicon Valley is the only place in the world that does not want to become like Silicon Valley.
Wait, okay. What? This feels like a riddle. I feel like I'm under a bridge and a little troll came out and told me a riddle. What is this riddle?
Well, I mean, everybody wants to become Silicon Valley, except if you already are.
Okay, okay.
So, Silicon Valley is sort of like has captured the imagination of the world.
Because what? It's like a center of innovation and like vests?
It's center of innovation and startups and unicorns and billionaires and
got it.
And
it's like cool billionaires that wear sweatshirts and that, you know, may have created a social media outlet that could bring down democracy. Kind of that, like that.
It's something like that. So in Silicon Valley, 54% of the technical workers, what they call the STEM workers, the science, mm-hmm. technology, engineering, and math workers, 54% mm-hmm. are foreigners.
Oh my goodness, that's cool.
And the other 46% are not Californians.
Shut up. Wait.
Even though California is a state of 40 million people, only 18% are Californians.
Wait.
So the secret of Silicon Valley is the incredible capacity to attract talent.
Wow. Yeah, because you go there and it's not that nice.
Well, I don't know. I like it.
Really? You know, I'm not a huge fan of California. But okay, so within those people that aren't from the U.S., What are some countries that are represented in that?
There's a lot of Indians. There's a lot of Asian, East Asians. And interestingly enough, there's this professor at Berkeley. Her name is Annalise Saxenian. Mm-hmm. She wrote a very interesting book on how these foreigners that went to Silicon Valley ended up transforming their home countries. So you have cities like Bangalore and Hyderabad that are mm-hmm. deeply connected to Silicon Valley on the basis of some people who went to Silicon Valley, got their H-1B visas, then got their H-1B visas renewed, then applied for a green card, never got one, could not renew their H-1B visa, so they went back home. And they went back home and they set up shop with their business contacts in Silicon Valley and dramatically transformed the economy of some places in India. And the same thing you can say about Taiwan, the same thing you can say about Korea, the same thing you can say about Israel. So these are places that are transformed by their diaspora, by people who've gone to other places where there's a lot of technology and acquired the know-how while working there, and then help transform their home country. We see it right now. I mean, there's a set of very interesting examples in Silicon Valley and Latin America. There's a guy called Alejandro Torrenegra. Mm-hmm. I hope he listens to us.
I mean, Alejandro Black Tower, that sounds like he is a villain in a superhero film. But you know what? I'm into it. Okay, what's up with him?
Well, he created a software company that solves business IT systems for companies. And he has a website called Torre. Uh-huh. And in order to solve these problems, he needs to hire people. But they don't need to be near him, so he can hire people anywhere. And since he's from Colombia, so he hired a bunch of Colombians. And so there's a bunch of Colombians now working for Torre. But since he needs more, he has had to set up shop elsewhere. And since he doesn't find enough trained people, he's had to train them in the business.
So that one person opening up shop in Latin America is bringing know-how to the rest of Latin America that otherwise perhaps wouldn't have had the opportunity.
Because he is in Silicon Valley.
Oh, wow.
Because he's in Silicon Valley. And there's another guy. I remember his first name because it was very memorable. First name is Bismarck.
Wow. Remember when you were going to call me Minerva? That would have really helped my branding. You know, there's a lot of Joannas, not a lot of Minervas. Anyway, okay, Bismarck.
He has another company also that does software development for other companies. And he needs talent. And since he cannot get the talent, he's from Guadalajara, Mexico. So he set up a school to train the people that he wants, that he needs to hire.
That's great.
And now he has like several tens of thousands of people that are being trained in part for his company, but they can go and do anything in Latin America and across the world. And that's because, you know, somebody from Guadalajara moved to Silicon Valley and had connections in Guadalajara.
And it's not enough to say, oh, we're in a connected world and because of the internet, like, you can get know-how from anywhere. There's also the human element of making those pieces connect together.
You know, getting know-how into brain is very difficult.
You're a teacher and you're my dad. You know that.
I know that. It's one thing, you know, to pass information.
Yeah.
So pass information is, you know, when did Christopher Columbus arrive?
Right.
And then if you don't remember it, you can Google it and you'll find that. It's a very different thing to learn, say, how to play tennis or to play the violin, right?
Yeah.
That takes many, many years of just practice and improvement and practice and improvement. And know-how is a little bit like that. It's not.
I will say this, though. The practice and improvement in sports, DNA has something to do with it. So thank you for your DNA, because I was never able to become a famous sports player. But we can leave that for another episode. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I can commiserate with you. It's not that we don't put the effort.
It's not that we don't put the effort. We just don't, no matter how much effort we put in, we are limited, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I still enjoy the physical activity.
Yeah, I know you're addicted to your bicycle.
Right now, yes. I've gone through phases.
You do.
My current phase is bicycle.
I don't know why boomer dads, they either get into barbecue, World War II, or bicycles. But you got into all three.
Well, they make a good combination. Where was I?
I don't know. We both have ADD. This I shouldn't have taken us off course. You were talking about putting know-how into brains.
Yes.
And how that's difficult.
It's difficult because it doesn't involve understanding. It's a wiring of the brain. It's like, you know, how do you learn how to walk? Well, it's not by people explaining you the concept of walking.
And you're so trying.
You just try to walk and you fall and you get up and until you sort of like your brain gets it.
Yeah.
But you don't know what muscles you move when you walk. You don't know how you regulate your heartbeat.
Yeah, I can't tell you. If someone had never walked a day in their life and they had to explain, I had to explain to them how to do it, I'd be like, you put one foot in front of the other. And that's so unhelpful because it's not like, oh, you lift your knee at this angle and then you don't think about it. Yeah. You just do it.
Exactly. And that's what once you have know-how, you cannot understand other people not understanding because you see it so obviously. That's what makes me lose my temper that. With you that, you know, I want you to do something. I see it. It's sort of like obvious and clear because I have know-how. Since you don't have that know-how, you don't see it. And I cannot understand why you don't see it if it's so obvious. So,
yes.
Yes. So you know why you understand, but you still get angry at me when I don't know how to do.
I try not to, but you know,
But it's like me when your mom don't understand how to like turn on a TV because you have 14 remote controls. Like this is now my revenge.
Exactly.
Is I get mad at you because you can't keep up with technology.
Exactly.
You know? It's a tale as old as time. This is what all generational strife is about, you know?
Absolutely.
Homework, specifically math homework, and remote controls.
Well, now you see, whenever I have a problem with some electronic piece,
yes,
equipment and so on, I know that my grandchildren are probably better than my children at fixing it.
I know, that's really depressing. I see it every day that I'm with my nieces and nephews. I feel that know-how is not something that someone taught them. They're just immersed in their environment, which is something that I wanted to ask you, which is, you know, some cultures and countries create specific types of talent. And it's not because the people are any biologically different. It's just because of their surroundings. And I remember reading about how a lot of the STEM industry is made up of specifically people from China because of how math is correlated and integrated into language. Like the language Mandarin, I don't know, I don't quote me, I'm not the professor here, but that even language has some mathematical like element to it. So math is like walking. It just becomes a more natural part of someone's existence versus maybe, I don't know, I'm trying to find reasons why there's certain cultures that tend to make people that are really good at certain things.
Well, in this case, it's a little bit of a new phenomenon. That is that the levels of schooling in China, mm-hmm, were historically very low. They had a very, very educated elite, mm-hmm, that was very nurtured to work for the state, mm-hmm, from, you know, millennia ago. But the majority of the people got very, very little education. And really, the growth of education in China, Korea, Japan is something less than a century old. So it's not these millennial old cultural things.
Totally.
But something more recent, mm-hmm, but probably mixed with something you say, which is the fact that their writing is not phonetic, but pictoric, mm-hmm, right? So a word is captured by a symbol. And in some sense, that's what math is. It's symbols.
Oh.
It's not phonetic. It's symbols that represent something. So there's some similarity between this pictoric interpretation of style of writing and math. Math is also, in some sense, pictoric.
It's like hieroglyphics to me. That's why I married someone that can do my taxes.
That's a division of knowledge, you see.
Interesting.
There's a moment you realize you're ready for what's next in your career. Maybe it's when you're trying a new scone recipe and think, I could open a cafe. Or maybe you're helping a coworker and say, I could teach a course on this. Whatever your moment is, it's never too early to plan for a career that lives longer. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. For skills training, resume tips, and job listings, visit aarp.org/work.
Shining through CIDP to me means being able to do what you want to do and not what the disease is telling you you can't do. Don't give in to the disease. It's not easy, but I'm going to do it. And like I've told people, I may have CIDP, but CIDP don't have me.
Sign up at shiningthroughcidp.com to get real CIDP stories and resources.
The interesting thing is that what I think is the right way to think about it is that when suddenly a society starts to absorb technology and starts to learn to do more things, then the payoff to getting a better education starts going up.
Wait, so you're saying once there's more opportunities for these more specific jobs, the more reason there is for education to be an impetus.
Yes. So families suddenly realize that the kids that got a little bit more schooling did much better than the kids that didn't, because then they got into these jobs in these semiconductor firms or in these car manufacturers and these other things and or they got into R&D and whatever. And so they realize that investments in a child's education pays off in terms of a different lifestyle. If what you were going to do is to work on a farm the rest of your life, it didn't matter if you could read Homer in the original or not, right? So it was not related to your prosperity. I mean, it's very interesting if you remember Fiddler on the Roof. There's this soliloquy, a song by Tevye, where he says, if I were a rich man.
Yeah.
And then he says, well, if I were a rich man, I would spend all my time reading and learning. So he would read and learn and study the Bible and so on as a way of, you know, spending his wealth, not as a way of getting rich.
Wealth. Oh, that's such an interesting contrast to what we're all taught, because everyone is like, well, I gotta read, I gotta get smart, I gotta make money, and then I'm gonna go to Hawaii and wakeboard, you know. I'm not gonna read Homer to relax when I'm rich. This is so interesting. You're very interesting. I should talk to you more often about these things. I would take your course. I recommend it. You know, I remember growing up, I would ask you like what you wanted me to be when I grow up. And you always said, that's not up to me. You have to follow your passions. You have to follow what you're interested in. And I will support your education no matter what you want to do. But for you, it was different, wasn't it? Like you as a kid, you were very, very smart. You were bored at school and you wanted to study astronomy, right?
Physics
and astronomy. But your dad, Papote, who was a Holocaust survivor who only got a second grade education and was able to make a very profitable company, knowing, you know, very little, quote unquote, what we consider school knowledge. You're very much into education. So you are an academic. What made you decide to study economics specifically? And what made you so interested in what you do, which, by the way, has inspired me to find passion in what I do? You love what you do. So what inspired you?
So let me say that the excuses I gave myself to why study economics all turned out to be wrong.
Oh my God.
So I wanted to study physics and philosophy. And those were taught in schools of art and science, where art is a word that comes from Greek that means like a craft. Mm-hmm. And arts and sciences didn't mean art,
right,
in the artsy interpretation. But my dad didn't know that. So he said, you know, so you finished high school. So high school in Spanish is bachiller. Mm-hmm. And then are you going to university, but not to university, but to a college? Well, you went to a college already, a colegio. So
there's a lot of language issues here.
So he said, no, if you go to university, it is to get a profession, to get a professional degree, something that you can use to earn a living.
A hard skill.
So he says engineering, okay, but arts and science, no. So he laid the law and said, no, you know, you have to go to a school of engineering, not to a school of arts and science, because that's very fluffy.
The irony that most of his grandchildren are pretty much in the arts, except for like one doctor. Okay, anyway, continue.
So I found a program in applied and engineering physics.
That's a lot of words.
Yeah, so it's like applied physics at Cornell. So
like using physics for like real world stuff.
Yeah, it was a degree in engineering. So okay. It's sort of like it was good enough for my dad, and yeah, it was close enough to what I wanted to do. So I ended up doing that. I would have been happier had I studied in arts and science, but I learned a lot of interesting stuff, electric circuits, thermodynamics, material science, etc.
You studied with Bill Nye. Bill Nye was in
your
class. Yes.
And then in my senior year, I took two courses in economics, a little bit because I had taken philosophy and philosophy of science, and then I kind of started to think that social sciences are actually harder than physical sciences. And
well, because it's intangible, like
because
you
it's
know,
harder to make progress, because you know, you cannot isolate things in the lab
because they're people. You could isolate them, but you know, the Geneva Convention.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, it made it intellectually more interesting, because before that I would have said, no, I want to do hard stuff.
Yeah.
And suddenly it appeared that it was hard. And secondly, I said to myself, I want to go back to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And I would spend my summers in Venezuela working at the National Institute of Scientific Research in the physics department. And I realized that to go back to Venezuela as a physicist probably made little sense because...
Well, as we were talking about before, what a physicist do in Venezuela if the hospital is not specialized for physicists?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But economies are different. So it would make sense to go back as an economist, but it would not make sense to go back as a physicist.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up switching my PhD application to economics.
How old were you?
I was like 21.
What? You got your PhD at 21?
No, I got my PhD a few weeks before turning 25.
Oh, okay.
So.
Cool. I got my UCB improv diploma when I was 25. So anyway.
Well, I mean, improv is very useful if you're teaching.
That'd be true.
Because, you know, then you can, you know, you get a question from the audience and what do you do with it? Right?
Yeah. It's also very useful in meeting a lot of white guys called Connor that are all very nice. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
So I went back to Venezuela, but it ended up being that I went back to Venezuela for something like a decade or maybe 12 years.
Yeah.
But then the rest of my life, I have been back in the U.S. So I also thought that economics was going to do more progress during my lifetime than physics because it was just a younger science and it was bound to...
Like Newton kind of was like the rock star of physics.
Yeah.
But economics, like rock star is what, like Adam Smith or something? Or...
Yeah, but even there, you know, the current economics, probably you want to say Marshall or somebody like that, which is a century ago. But progress in economics, I thought, was bound to be faster during my lifetime. And I think that that also turned out not to be true, that I see the transformation in our understanding of the physical world from what I was taught to what is currently thought as being dramatically more significant than the amount of progress that has been done in economics. So I got into economics for maybe all the wrong excuses I gave myself
Yes.
in those days, but it generated an enormous passion in me and trying to understand how the world works. How could you possibly act on it to improve it? You know, what can be done to, you know, make prosperity more accessible to more people? So it sounded like very important to ask these questions and very interesting the kinds of things you could find as potential answers. I've always liked to reimagine answers that are different from the ones I started to interpret the world with. So I'm perfectly happy to change the glasses to which I see the world. And I've done it several times over my career. And right now I'm trying to see to what extent I can create knowledge that is particularly useful to diagnose problems of lack of economic dynamism and figure out paths to prosperity. And that keeps me busy and entertained.
That seems like pretty important work. You know, every time I get interviewed, I get asked this question, which is like, how did you, a daughter of two economists, end up doing art? And my brother and sister are also both in the art space. But what you just described, which is trying to understand the world, I think, is hilo conductor in all of what we do, which is in the know-how in our house and at the dining table was asking questions why. Why are things a certain way? And trying to draw your own conclusions and create your own hypotheses, which I do in my everyday life consistently with comedy. So we kind of have... the same know-how, but just apply it in different ways.
Absolutely. I mean, I am always amazed at your ability. From the time you were very, very young, you would imitate people. But you would imitate aspects of people that nobody had paid attention to until you sort of like caught these little details. So in your imitation, you expressed an understanding of their nature, or an understanding of what makes them tick.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's something I can relate to. You're trying to get into the mind of somebody else, get into their perception of the world, and be able to describe it in ways that they would not be able to describe it, because fish don't know they are in water.
Yes.
They take water for granted. And so since you were kind of like out of water and we kind of like changed your waters too many times, you always complain by the fact that you went to too many schools. We moved you around between England, Caracas, Potomac, D.C., Boston, Caracas, back to, you know.
I think I went to 8 schools.
You had the ability to see people kind of like from an outside perspective in ways that they probably couldn't because they were in water. They were unaware of their water.
Right. And I always love observing things and why people are certain ways and trying to get to the core of that, which isn't, you know, just an exercise in being human. I think it's an exercise in science. It's like you find something odd out of the ordinary and try and figure out what's the source of it through experimentation. But my experimentation is just conversation, getting to know people, but sometimes a little research. But, you know, I do think there is a curiosity that it needs to be fed in both of us. And we're constantly curious about how the world ticks around us. And it makes life a lot more fun.
Absolutely. I think that in the end, it's, you know, playing brain games.
Well, you do love your Sudoku, so.
But brain games is useful both in science and in art. It's we're using the same part of the human body.
True words have never been smoking. Anyway, you got to get the barbecue ready because we have a barbecue party later today.
Yeah, your husband's birthday.
Yeah, we got a birthday celebration. Got some steaks. Got to pick up a cake. We're going to party, you know? Party how we know best, which is eating and hanging out.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Professor Hausman. It's been an honor to know you for 33 years, and thank you for making me. High five.
Thank you for being who you are.